The Taliban do believe that they are in a strong position, but I think the important thing to say is that I think that they are negotiating in good faith.
An inside look at Taliban negotiations. It's Thursday, October 15th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Coming up, Australia limits refugees. President Trump campaigns again, edging closer to a Supreme Court seat, COVID job training, and an unusual musical alliance. It's all on today's VOA Asia. NATO senior civilian representative to Afghanistan, Stefano Pontecorvo, says while both the Taliban and the Afghanistan Republic negotiation teams in Doha have entered the talks in good faith, the rigidity of the Taliban team is holding up progress. He sat down with VOA's Aisha Tanzim in Kabul to discuss what he said were unacceptably high levels of violence, the future of NATO's commitment to Afghanistan, and what the country might look like in 10 years.
You've had recent contacts with the Taliban. You were in Doha. How did you find them? Not just their attitude towards the negotiations in general, but also toward the Afghan team that they're negotiating with.
On the atmospherics, which is the easiest part to answer. The atmospherics between the team and the Afghan Republic team and the Taliban are good. They respect each other. They at times have meals with each other. And the personal interaction is good, also with the women of the team. I met the women of the team, and they also confirmed this to me. They're, by the way, they are exceptional ladies, one of which was... is a near Nobel laureate, but all four of them are exceptional ladies. So the atmospherics are very good. As concerns the talks themselves, I think both sides are in the talks in good faith. But the Taliban are a bit rigid, which is the cause of the stalemate, the current stalemate in the talks on the code of conduct as we read in open source. I'm speaking a bit military, but it's an open source on the newspapers and so on. The talks themselves are inching forward, but I must say the Taliban attitude is generally not helpful.
You said both the teams respect each other. I've heard that the Taliban think of themselves as the victors in this negotiation. Did you get that sense?
Well, the Taliban do believe that they are in a strong position. I don't know if actually they believe that they are the victors, but I think the important thing to say is that I think that they are negotiating in good faith. What is happening off the table is very concerning. I'm referring to the increase of violence. The violence levels we've seen, what's happening in Helmand, is totally unacceptable. That is majorly Taliban driven. And it has to go down because it is inconsistent with a smooth peace negotiation and, we believe, with the U.S.-Taliban agreement itself.
You just mentioned Helmand, the level of violence. Lashkargah is a city. They're not supposed to attack the cities. Do they just get away with violating the agreement, or is there any consequence for them?
I think there will be consequences, but you know, this is a delicate matter, and before you call a violation, evidence is being ascertained, and it's not looking good. But before you give you pass judgment, you have to have evidence, and that is what RS and the US are gathering in this moment.
And then what about the security situation in general in the country? Does it look like it's deteriorating? Because it's not just Helmand and Lashkargah. The Taliban are trying to put pressure on cities, but also capital Kabul. We've seen Taliban letters. We've heard of random patrols, even though it's the outskirts, but this is the capital.
I'd say that there is the level of criminality is creeping, going higher, and that's not a good sign. But again, I referred already to the level of violence. The level of violence is totally unacceptable. It has to go down. There's Afghans are being killed by the day, by IEDs, by attacks, and violence calls for violence. And so there is it is a tragic situation. this has to go down. There is a level of violence that has not been seen in the last 10 years. That has to go down.
And if the level of violence doesn't go down, what happens?
I wouldn't speculate on that.
Join us tomorrow for part two of our exclusive interview with NATO Senior Civilian Representative to Afghanistan, Stefano Pontecorvo. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Thousands of protesters demand Thailand Prime Minister's resignation. Australia concerns over reported China coal import ban. In southern India, record rains kill 15. India frees top Kashmiri leader. Great Barrier Reef has lost over 50% of its coral. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories with photos, text, and video at Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The coronavirus pandemic has prompted Australia to cut its annual acceptance of refugees from 18,750 to 13,750, effective immediately. Official documents suggest the cuts to the humanitarian program will save almost $700 million. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia has a long history of accepting the displaced for resettlement. Since 1945, it's given sanctuary to more than 800,000 refugees. However, the government has said the financial consequences of the pandemic have forced it to cut the annual quota by 5,000 people to 13,750. The Refugee Council of Australia called the announcement shattering. Its chief executive is Paul Power.
We were probably expecting that there might be some short-term reduction. What we weren't expecting was that the government would cut the program over the next 3 years and use that as a budget-saving measure.
Australia closed its borders to foreign nationals, including refugees and migrants, to curb the spread of COVID-19 in March. Officials have indicated the restrictions could remain until late next year. The government has said it will spend about $9 million to help young refugees find work and adapt to life in Australia through community programs. Australia is also cutting its skilled migration program, but priority will be given to innovators, investors, and job creators as the nation faces its first recession since the early 1990s. Canberra will also insist that foreign partners of existing Australian residents pass an English language test before they're given a permanent visa. The controversial immigration requirements would apply from mid-2021. Acting Immigration Minister Alan Tudge.
We will require an applicant and a sponsor to have met functional level English or to have at least made reasonable efforts to learn English. And by reasonable efforts, we mean for most people that will be doing about 500 hours of free English language classes.
30% of the Australian population was born overseas. In 2019, every single country from around the world was represented in Australia. The largest groups of migrants come from England, China, and India. Australia has been built on successive waves of immigration, but it retains an uncompromising stance on asylum seekers arriving by boat who are denied entry and transported to processing camps in the South Pacific. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, thousands of Thai anti-government protesters overtook Bangkok's Democracy Monument Wednesday in a symbolic move after facing off with pro-monarchy groups as tensions rise 3 months into the protest movement. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. It is President Donald Trump's first week back on the campaign trail since his COVID-19 diagnosis after his doctor said he is no longer infectious to others. With 3 weeks left to go until Election Day, Trump and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden are crisscrossing the battleground states this week to energize their supporters. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details. Trump
is the best. From Florida to Ohio, supporters rally around their candidates as the countdown continues to Election Day. In the battleground state of Florida, attendees received temperature checks for President Donald Trump's first rally since he was diagnosed with COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus.
But it's great to be back in my home state, Florida, to make my official return to the campaign trail.
In actions and words, Trump addressed his recovery from COVID-19.
Now they say I'm immune. I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience. I'll walk in there. I'll kiss everyone in that audience.
The science is unclear on immunity to COVID-19. But in quite a different type of gathering in Ohio, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden criticized Trump's handling of his illness.
It's just reckless personal conduct since his diagnosis as well has been unconscionable. And the longer Donald Trump is president, the more reckless he gets.
Trump may be trying to project strength in his response, says Stanford University political scientist Bruce Kane.
I'm not sure that there was a better way to spin it. I mean, certainly if he looked vulnerable and weak and sick, it would have been bad for him too.
But Trump's treatment of his illness and recovery could backfire, says Kane.
His reaction to the COVID and some of the statements he's made about COVID and his immunity and lack of vulnerability to it are not playing well with the older voters. And Florida is a state with a lot of retirees, a lot of people who are vulnerable to not only getting sick, but potentially dying from COVID.
While Trump won Florida in 2016, it is up for grabs in 2020. The latest poll shows Biden with a slim lead over Trump in Florida, a critical state for both candidates.
What Mr. Trump is trying to do is to get his people out, get them energized, get them out to vote. Because if he can get white male voters in particular to show up in big numbers, he can offset some of the losses that he's had among women and among older voters. The emphasis of the Biden campaign is essentially make sure you don't make the same mistakes that Hillary did.
I want to thank the Hispanic Americans.
Latinos, projected to be the nation's largest group of ethnic minority voters, will be a factor in the election. National polls show them backing Biden more than 2-1, although Trump does better among Cuban Americans, a major voting group in Florida. The issue for voters that stands out above all others, says Kane, will be COVID-19. And Americans will cast their ballots to show who they want at the helm as the country fights the disease. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Flash flooding hit the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, Wednesday, as high water nationwide caused by heavy rain killed at least 12 people over the past few days. You'll find this and much more on VOA 60, as well as the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. U.S. Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett told the U.S. Senate on Tuesday she would not bring her own agenda to the bench if she is confirmed to the nation's highest court. In the first full day of questioning from senators, Barrett deflected a range of inquiries on issues impacting a wide range of Americans, from abortion to health care to gun rights. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Day one of 3 days of intense questions from U.S. senators to U.S. President Donald Trump's nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, who pledged not to bring a personal agenda to court cases.
I can't take policy positions or express my personal views before the committee, because my personal views don't have anything to do with how I would decide cases.
With each senator allowed two rounds of questions this week, Republicans Tuesday praised Barrett as a highly qualified judge, whose background as a mother of seven and devout Catholic would bring a new perspective to the court.
What I want the American people to know, I think it's okay to be religiously conservative. I think it's okay to be personally pro-choice. I think it's okay to live your life in a traditional Catholic fashion, and you still be qualified for the Supreme Court.
But Democrats grilled Barrett on a case she could face immediately if confirmed, disputes related to the presidential election.
When the president declares he needs his nominee to secure his reelection, and then the nominee is ran through the Senate in record time during the middle of an election, some are going to question that nominee's impartiality.
I have had no conversation with the president or any of his staff on how I might rule in that case. It would be a gross violation of judicial independence for me to make any such commitment or for me to be asked about that case and how I would rule.
Democrats tried and failed to probe how Barrett would rule on contentious issues from an upcoming case that could overturn a key provision of the Obama administration's health care law.
But I can't express views on cases or pre-commit to approaching a case any particular way.
To declining to say if the landmark 1973 Roe versus Wade abortion case should be overturned, frustrating Democrats.
On something that is really a major cause with major effect on over half of the population of this country, who are women, after all, it's distressing not to get a straight answer.
Barrett's approach to rule based only on the law drew praise from Republicans worried about judicial overreach.
You got a lifetime appointment, and if you do lawmaking, we can't vote you out of office. Lawmaking's our job. If people don't like what we do, they can vote us out of office.
Polling shows a slight majority of Americans say a Supreme Court nomination should wait until after the presidential election. Yet Barrett's nomination is expected to easily advance to a full vote on the Senate floor by the week of October 26. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia, a new program in New Orleans, Louisiana, is helping people laid off because of the coronavirus learn new work skills. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports on how service industry members are being trained to work in the healthcare industry.
A program by the nonprofit group Resilience Force aims to improve community health outreach during the coronavirus pandemic while addressing the jobless situation that many found themselves in, said Executive Director Saket Soni.
With the pandemic, what we're doing is taking people laid off through the unemployment crisis and retraining them to be resilience workers. Specifically, as community health workers, they'll be going door to door, training people on best practices during COVID, helping people isolate, helping people connect to contact tracers.
He says the program includes pay for training and resources like personal protective equipment, links to federal clinics, free COVID testing sites, and emergency care. The healthcare training is a natural fit for Andre Wright, a yoga instructor and father of two, who is one of the program's first.
Knowing that I'm not only able to create a change right now and address a very much need right now, but also set myself up to further in that particular field is, you know, unmatched.
Rosella Ampuero, who lost her job with a hotel staffing company, says being employed is critical, but she's also happy to be serving her community.
I needed to find ways to like help them out because I felt like it was my responsibility as a just human being.
The recruits have spent recent weeks in training, canvassing churches and neighborhoods to determine needs in the community. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Three countries, three musical traditions, one shared dream. Slava Lechia is a cross-country collaboration of folk musicians from Belarus, Ukraine, and the Appalachian region of the United States. The project was meant to be just about the music, but then reality got in the way. Maria Pruz shares the story.
Which side are you on?
Made up of musicians from three different countries, but with shared rural musical roots, the musical project Slava Lechia is a unique collaborative experiment. This music project began over a year ago when the cultural events manager Nadia Ilkevich invited a Belarusian folk musician Serzhuk Dohushau to perform at Ohio University.
Musicians from Brother Hill and the Hill Spirits band, a local folk band, they attended this event and they fell in love with Belarusian traditional music, with Slavic traditions. And after the concert, they jammed for 7 hours in a row. During this jam, they layered up tunes, Appalachian tunes with Belarusian traditional tunes, and they find out that it's like perfectly fit with each other. Someone said, "This is Slava Lechia." So this is Slavic and Appalachian.
Later, musicians invited a Ukrainian folk band Turban to join the project. After multiple remote sessions, they all met in January for the first time as the US band visited Belarus and Ukraine. Their experience was filmed and later became a part of the Road to Slava Lechia documentary.
We had a lot of plans with Slava Lechia project for this August, so we had to go to Belarus to perform for art residency where all three bands are making together performance and then perform the Sprava Festival. But coronavirus and then elections in Belarus interrupted our plans. In the end of July, we saw this news from Belarus where they already tried to suppress protests.
To support Belarusian people, the musicians have remotely recorded a cover version of the 1930s American protest anthem, "Which Side Are You On?"
Oh, workers, can you take this? So tell me how you...
They kept some of the original lyrics, but also adapted parts and translated it into three languages.
For us, it was really important to have this song in three languages at the same time. So the world and we all can feel that we are together despite of our differences, languages or distance.
The song could be heard near the Belarusian embassy in Washington, D.C. at the time of the Belarusian presidential elections in August, as well as on the Belarusian streets during the peaceful protests. The musicians say that despite the uncertainty and confusion that pandemic has brought to the industry, now is a great time to create something new.
Music is the voice of a revolution. So right now as an artist, if you're really wanting to impact or take a part in social change, this is the time that artists dream of, to be able to make pieces that are relevant to a movement, mm-hmm. relevant to activism, relevant to what you're fighting for.
Musicians say their primary goal was to remind people of the importance of traditions, but it is now shifted on to show how music can overcome language barriers and cultural differences, that despite borders and distance, artists can experiment and create something new. Maria Bruce for VOA News, Washington.
We're glad you were able to join us for today's VOA Asia. We continue online at Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You can also download our full-length 25-minute VOA Asia programs at our website, voanews.com. Our thanks go to those who helped bring this program to you, our managing editor, Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.